Welcome to Canary in a Cornfield, a podcast from the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, where we explore how the policies that shape our food and farming systems impact our health, our communities, and our future. As most of our listeners probably know, the Harkin Institute was founded upon the retirement of longtime public servant and Iowa legend Tom Harkin, in order to continue doing high-quality work on the policy issues that were important to him. Today's episode is the first of a two-part series focused on avian influenza, also known as H5N1, and of course commonly referred to as bird flu. This topic is probably the one that most inspired the name of the podcast, since I've often wondered about what Iowa's status as the biggest producer of eggs might mean in terms of the potential risks we face from zoonotic diseases such as avian influenza. Zoonotic diseases, by the way, refers to diseases that can be transferred between other animals and humans. We haven't heard as much about avian flu in the news lately, but that's not because the threat has gone away. In fact, with the fall season arriving and the current migration of wild birds, it's likely that outbreaks of avian flu will be much more prominent in upcoming weeks. Another reason we're hearing less about the topic is because of the current administration's decision to deprioritize some of the reporting about outbreaks, which will be discussed more in the next episode. This first interview with Dr. Gregory Gray, a professor in infectious disease epidemiology in the departments of internal medicine, microbiology, and immunology at the University of Texas Medical Branch, is focused on the science of avian influenza from one of the world's leading experts. The next episode will be focused more on the policy implications and the challenges that we're currently facing. So with that, I will jump into my interview with Dr. Gregory Gray. I am excited today to be joined by Professor Gregory Gray. I was fortunate to have Professor Gray as a speaker at a conference that we organized last September, and he is a world-renowned expert on avian influenza, which is a topic that is increasingly important across the United States and in Iowa. So Professor Gray, thank you so much for joining us today, and we're really excited to hear more from you.
Well, Adam, thanks for engaging me and for your kind words as well.
So I guess to start out, maybe you could let people know, what is avian influenza? How is it different from other types of flu or other seasonal flus that come up? Why should we care about avian influenza or bird flu?
Well, avian influenza collectively are strains of the influenza A viruses that frequent birds, and they're reservoired frequently in aquatic birds. Sometimes they don't even harm the aquatic birds, but when they infect poultry and have certain characteristics, they can be very deadly to domestic livestock poultry. We also, as humans, are infected with usually different strains, and those strains commonly cause seasonal influenza and then infrequently worldwide epidemics of influenza. So it's a subset of a type of influenza strains that frequent birds.
There have been news stories that have been coming up over the last year where we've been hearing more about birds being culled or examples of cases getting transmitted to other livestock species. So can you give a rough overview of what's been happening over the past year or so in terms of avian influenza?
Well, we've been following the different strains of the avian influenza for some time. And beginning in roughly 2020, we have seen some changes in the strains that were circulating in wild birds. And particularly beginning at that time and until really 2024 early, we've seen a lot of strange infections in other animals from a specific type of H5N1 in the avian influenza group, and it has spilled over to many different mammals in North America and throughout the world.
If I'm understanding correctly, part of the reason why it's been especially concerning this time versus sometimes we've heard about avian influenza in the decades past is that there's more instances of spillover, and that that could have implications for human populations as well?
Yeah, that's very accurate. We have in this country never seen some of these mammals, the wild mammals, particularly carnivores, be infected with avian flu. We think of wild dogs or canids, wolves and coyotes, and then, of course, even large carnivores like bears and a lot of different wild cats have shown unusual manifestations and sometimes death with infections. And so it's pretty clear that something had changed in this particular strain of H5N1, which is often called 2.3.4b. And that gave that virus a larger range of species to infect. And of course, recently in early 2024, we saw it move into dairy cows. And how that occurred, we're not really clear, but it spread like wildfire in the dairy cows and then also infected cats on the farms and sometimes people, as well as poultry farms, both fryers and egg farms. So suddenly we are encountering this strain on a large scale in the United States. In fact, it's been estimated to be the largest outbreak in the history of the United States of avian influenza.
Wow, that's disturbing to hear, but it tracks with what I've been hearing about in the news. Just to back up and make sure everyone's on the same page, can you say a little bit more about what it means for there to be different strains of avian influenza and how mutation might play a role in what we're
sure? Sure. The influenzas, and there are four major types, A is one, have segmented genomes, and particularly influenza A has eight genomes. And when two different viruses infect the same cell, then the exchange of those segments can be shuffled like cards, and out can come a progeny virus that has a mixture of those segments. And when that progeny virus continues to have the affinity to infect, for instance, mammals or birds, any pre-existing immunity in that mammal or bird could be negated. And basically, you've got a virus that's going to not be controlled, previous immune responses. And so we get explosive epidemics. And that type of an exchange of material is called reassortment. And frequently, it's been responsible for worldwide epidemics or pandemics in humans. So when we see major change in the virus, we're in trouble. Now, there are other changes that occur through other mechanisms that are smaller in their changes. And sometimes we refer to that as recombination or even mutations. But we monitor for all three of these different events, you know, what strains of these viruses are circulating in humans primarily, but also in livestock. We do a lot of surveillance in pigs and chickens, and also in wild animals. When we see unusual manifestations of infection, like strange neurologic conditions in the birds, and then sudden deaths in birds that are unexplained. So it's through these imperfect surveillance systems in humans, in domestic animals and wildlife, that we've learned that these particular H5N1 strains are really taking hold in North America. And it's pretty clear now, with more than 1,000 dairy farms infected and many, many different detections in every state, that these strains of virus are here to stay. And so we're having to deal with this in a way we haven't dealt with before. They're a continual threat to livestock, particularly the poultry industry, which in the past has not tolerated any infections. They kill all the birds that are exposed or infected on an individual farm, or at least in a series of barns in close proximity to detections. Now, we don't kill all the dairy cow because they are much more valuable and they tolerate the infection much better. But it is a concern that the milk that the dairy cows generate might transmit a live virus to someone consuming the milk, like humans. It certainly seems to have transmitted the virus to cats on the farms. So a whole conundrum, if you will, of new problems that's been associated with this clade, we say, of particular genotypes of H5N1, taking hold and becoming endemic, or we say enzootic, in wild animals and livestock.
And so in Iowa, we've had a series of news stories about different poultry operations that have had to do mass culling of flocks that have gotten infected. Is it the case that places like Iowa, where there are large numbers of battery cage operations or broiler chicken operations, is there more of a risk of the avian influenza spreading quickly between those, or is this unrelated to the density within?
Well, I think there is a factor of density with respect to transmission, and then for some animals that tolerate influenza A viruses, becoming enzootic. For instance, pigs have a big tolerance for viruses of the influenza A type, and we often find in the largest farms, the most densely populated farms, multiple strains of influenza A viruses. Now, we don't tolerate it in poultry, in this country, at least not thus far, but many of the poultry farms and in the developing world, particularly in Asia, where we do research, have a lot of different, what we call our low pathogenic strains of influenza. And through the mechanisms I described previously, those strains can mix with new strains and out can come a more dangerous strain. So particularly in areas where influenza A or avian influenza viruses are enzootic in poultry farms and developing countries, we need to really keep a close pulse on that, lest a progeny virus from those farms make its way on an airplane or movement in humans or movement of animals to the United States and cause even more, if you will, than the H5N1 is doing here.
Right. I know having to assess risk is a complicated process, but if you had to try to quantify or give an estimate of how much risk there would be specifically to human health of people getting avian influenza and it becoming something bigger.
Well, I think you make a really good point. It's really hard to quantify that risk. Now, our colleagues at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention actually have a tool for that. And they have a number of different measurements of the importance of the virus strains and use them to prioritize development of interventions. But I think we still believe that there's a huge species barrier between the poultry and the cows and humans with respect to the H5N1 strains. After all, we've seen more than 1,000 dairy farms and only around 70 people that have been documented to be infected. So there's something that's blocking the transmission to humans. And really, while we've seen other human-to-human transmission with similar viruses in other countries, we haven't seen it yet here. It doesn't mean it won't happen. And most of the illnesses, with the exception of one death, have been pretty mild, and probably a lot are subclinical, meaning they don't even seek health care. And so the risk to humans of these strains is thought to be rather low. Some might say, possibly medium. But even so, we know that a change in the virus could make it more virulent to humans. And so there's a big new emphasis that we, even more closely than ever before, study these viruses and prepare interventions in case it explodes and starts causing very severe illness in people. So you're suddenly saying the U.S. government invests in vaccines, both for agriculture and also for humans, that might mitigate an explosive outbreak of H5N1. We're seeing the development of new technologies. You have something called universal vaccines. In other words, vaccines that would protect against most any strain. We're seeing new approaches to vaccines that might be good for animals, such as the mRNA approach that we've used effectively for COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 virus, and a lot of new technologies being developed to help us get a better handle on the problem, you know, such as new diagnostic tests, new serologic tests to evaluate the immune response to natural infection and eventually the vaccines among both humans and, for instance, livestock that are long-lived. So some cows, for instance, can be maintained in a dairy herd for, you know, a dozen or so years. So how often, if you had a vaccine that was good for them, would you give that vaccine? And humans, of course, we give it every year, seasonal influenza vaccines. So we know that the antibodies that are generated with those seasonal influenza vaccines wane over time, and we have to boost. So how often do you do that? And the only way to determine that is to have good serologic assessments of a protective immune response. So there's a lot of new technology being explored as a way to counter these threats. And, you know, a lot of concern among professionals in human health care and animal health care that we do what we can now to stop this before it changes in some way to become more transmissible to humans or more dangerous or virulent to humans or animals.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, there's a pretty big difference based on how potentially bad things can go. So a 1 in 20 chance of getting a small cold is not a big deal, but a 1 in 20 chance of a pandemic or something more serious is actually a pretty big deal. So even if we don't know exactly the likelihood of it getting worse, the potential consequences seem bad enough that we should probably do something about it. I wanted to ask, just from my lay perspective or my intuitive reaction when I first heard about avian influenza and that there had already been some vaccines developed, is, well, why not just immediately vaccinate all of the flocks everywhere and deploy the vaccine as much as possible? And it seems like that hasn't really happened, right? It's been a little bit slow how much vaccination has taken place. So can you say more about why we haven't just vaccinated every animal that we can?
Well, the key reason why not is we haven't had the vaccines that have been targeted towards, you know, for instance, livestock species and shown to be effective. And then once we have those vaccines and know they work, there's the question of cost. And then on top of that, because we want to be able to export animals in animal agriculture, there are sometimes prohibitions when in exporting animals that may have some evidence of, for instance, an H5 infection. So you have to be able to discriminate a natural or wild H5 infection from an immune response that's due to a vaccine. And so having that ability is one of the desired characteristics of agricultural vaccines. We need something that can help us distinguish wild infection from vaccination so we protect our businesses. And I'll just say that there are major new efforts to mitigate all those problems, new types of vaccines that you could distinguish. We're working with Thomas Jefferson University, who has a rabies-based virus vaccine with an H5 component that would basically give livestock antibodies to both rabies and H5 and likely protect them. So that would meet the latter requirement to show any H5 antibodies are due to the vaccine and not wild infection. And the idea that this vaccine might be a lower cost is attractive to the industry, and the production could be ramped up rather quickly. In contrast, most of the time where we've made human vaccines, they've been based on the use of viruses that are selected through various processes and grown out in eggs. And you can know with the increase in cost of eggs and the imperfection of that production, it takes us a long time to respond to a new strain with the old egg-based technology of vaccine development. And so having some other way to do this, where you could rapidly change based on the new detections of strange viruses, is really attractive, both for human and veterinary healthcare.
That's really fascinating. I've been wondering about that for a long time, so I appreciate that answer. You've touched a little on this already, but how would you describe how public health agencies and the industry are responding to this? And are there any things that you think should be happening that aren't currently happening?
Well, I'll say that the government is responding pretty aggressively, despite, you know, the new administration's making cutbacks in government spending. We're seeing opportunities. The USDA has just come out with a call for proposals totaling $200 million available for new approaches to this problem, both the development of vaccines and diagnostics and other ways to stop it. We heard that the federal government under the NIH is putting a half billion or $500 million towards developing good vaccines. So we're seeing some investments, although there's a lot of concern with, you know, the drawdown and the size of the personnel in some of the government agencies, that some of the talent in this realm would be hampered. But I'm not giving up on the government yet. I think the government recognizes this as a problem, as do scholars all over the world. And people are looking to us because it's in our backyard right now, to try to do something about it, to protect other nations and to be an example of excellence in science. And so I think we're moving in that direction. It's just, you know, it's challenging, and it's a little bit hard, you know, to embrace right now all the new technologies. And while many would say that the mRNA vaccine is a very attractive technology to use in this influenza A avian flu domain, my understanding, it's not being looked at as aggressively as it might have been a couple years ago. And so that's a technology that I think many people would say, hey, it's a better way to go, because we can generate one of those vaccines really quickly, whereas the egg-based production, it may or may not work, and it could take months before you could generate vaccines to protect a lot of humans.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know there was a story about an Iowa State researcher who studied avian influenza who lost her job temporarily and then was hired back. So I'm glad to hear that the current administration is taking it very seriously and that there are these opportunities. Although, you know, some of the things that you mentioned about vaccines, it's great that vaccines are still on the table with the NIH. But this kind of leads to another one of my questions, which is just, you know, we had this recent experience with the COVID pandemic and all of the different measures that people took from that. Has that changed, do you think, the way in which various groups view or are reacting to avian influenza? And I guess that could be for the better, where we might be better prepared for certain things, or the backlash against some of the public health implications like vaccines, is that influencing any of the approaches?
Yeah, so I think we've always had people that are reticent to embrace new technologies. I think Edward Jenner, who generated the first vaccines against smallpox, was heckled and made fun of and terribly demoralized. And yet we know now, having eradicated that horrific disease, that it was largely due to vaccinations. Now, have the vaccines improved over time? You betcha. Well, you've got much better, much more refined, we'd say less reactogenic vaccines. And we're getting better all the time at targeting those vaccines in ways that protect humans with causing, you know, minimum side effects. But they're never perfect. There's always going to be a, you know, proportion of people that have some sort of vaccine-related morbidity. But what one has to do is compare the incidence of that morbidity with the threat. And I'll tell you, you know, given the threat of measles that we're seeing right now, and polio is continuing to spread, we've seen mumps cases, and the severe illnesses that all three of those can cause, especially in children, there's in my mind, there's no reason to doubt the effectiveness of using those vaccines. You know, it's paramount in our approach to protecting kids from acute serious illness. And then some of these wild viruses cause chronic illnesses, you know, severe neurologic mental retardation, other effects that families have to suffer along with their child for many, many years. And so people that, you know, are advocates for vaccines, I say, are in the vast majority. Unfortunately, they don't normally have the loudspeaker that some of the people that are in the minority and you know, saying, why should my child have this? We haven't seen any measles in my community for 10 years. Well, look right now, it's spreading like it's in 17 states. And it's because we had people like this that we didn't meet the immune threshold of about 95% coverage to sort of stop measles. So, you know, vaccines have been among the most important interventions in public health that have ever been generated. And we need to embrace them and continue to improve them, you know, to improve public health.
Yeah, that's right. You're in Texas, so you're right in the thick of some of the measles discussions, I'm sure.
700 cases, I think, this week we heard. A total of 700 cases.
Yeah. So I guess one kind of big picture question for you, do you view avian influenza as primarily a problem that technology is needed to change? Is it just, you know, sort of a matter of good science, good public policy that relies on science is what we're going to need to address this problem? Or are there other dimensions of it that you think aren't being discussed enough?
Well, you have public health problems that are many and quite diverse. You know, it's one thing to talk about clean water, and we all respect that. And generally, we have a way, you know, to approach that. And that problem is sort of static in the sense that, you know, it's not continually changing from a nucleic acid base. You know, you have contaminants and you just have to mitigate it. The problem with avian flu are many because it is a much more complex problem and it affects, you know, many dimensions of human health, animal health, and environmental health. And so we have to bring together people from multiple disciplines and what we could say is a One Health way to help reduce this, mitigate this very complex problem. And using the example of, you know, contaminated water, you know, that too is multidimensional, but it's just not as, in my opinion, as complex. So what the farmer does over here in this area and how the veterinarian working on the farm can control avian flu can impact the movement of those viruses to the adjacent farm and explosive outbreaks there, which in turn could be associated with changes in the virus, sustainment in the environment. There's even been some studies recently in Czechoslovakia that explosive outbreaks in poultry farms could move in the air as far as 8 kilometers away. So you can set up all kinds of barriers stopping the movement of animal or people into your farm, and the virus would still make its way there. So what we say is that avian flu is a wicked or complex problem that requires multidisciplinary or One Health approaches and cooperation before we can control it. And you know, that is among the most challenging problems out there, emerging infectious diseases like avian flu, where we really have to find partners in all domains that are affected. And many people would say that avian flu is the greatest infectious disease threat for our generation. It is that severe. So if you ask what's going to cause among the respiratory viruses the next pandemic, avian flu is almost always up there in the list of priority pathogens.
That's definitely something to be nervous about in Iowa as we have these continuing outbreaks. You mentioned the One Health approach, and I know you have been a leader in that approach. Can you just say a little bit more for listeners about what One Health is and how that...
We really have got to partner with agriculture, right? And in new ways, those of us in the cities that have forgotten our roots, we need to respect that farming and agricultural businesses are what keep us healthy because they provide food. And, you know, generally we in the past, there's been a lot of animosity between public health and farming, and that is a barrier in helping to stop avian flu. For instance, a number of the farms were approached at the dairy farms by the U.S. government when the H5N1 outbreak occurred, and there was a lot of pushback. We don't want your help because we think you're going to hurt our business model. And so we have to find ways to work together in a One Health way that doesn't threaten the agricultural businesses. And we've had some conferences here at the University of Texas Medical Branch, actually in April of last year, where we brought together experts to discuss some of the biggest problems for food security. How do we keep agriculture healthy? How do we work together in new ways that don't threaten each other? How do we listen to the problems and suggest, for instance, interventions to those problems in agriculture using the greater resources in human healthcare? And so this kind of a One Health research conference, I think, has a lot of leverage. And we had people going to the meeting and say, wow, I've never heard these kind of talks before. And it was really diverse. We had people from the dairy, the beef cattle, the poultry, the pork board, the green leafy vegetables. We had government officials, academics, land-grant universities, healthcare settings, international scholars, all talking about these problems. And some people quipped, hey, these are my people. I just didn't know them. In other words, there was new thinking there when we brought together people that didn't often meet together and new ways to discuss collaborations.
So the mention of working with agriculture also reminds me that you're an expert in occupational health in particular. Are there special risks for people who are working in close proximity to these facilities, workers at poultry operations? Are there certain occupations where people are especially at risk if there was spillover?
Well, there are, and I think the U.S. government has done a lot towards educating the animal workers, if you will, on how to protect themselves. And many of the farms are requiring what we call our personal protective equipment in areas, for instance, that are closely related to food products. And so we're seeing more and more of that. We could use some improvements, though, in these personal protective equipment technologies because sometimes they're very uncomfortable to wear. Some of the gear gets very, very hot, and the compliance is not always great. The farm worker says, well, I'm not being watched right now. I'm not going to wear this stuff. And then sometimes the workers, if they're not severely ill or forego treatment, I'm not going to go in and tell anybody I have a respiratory illness because it might cause me to some harm or healthcare is not available. And so while these farms are often located in rural areas, we need to find ways to support the healthcare of the workers in those rural areas. And it's not always easy. But yeah, there are increased risks for people that work, for instance, in dairy cattle and poultry industries. That's pretty clear. And the vast majority of the 70 human infections were those people. In a similar fashion, we've seen people exposed to wildlife be at increased risk of wildlife infections. We do studies in live bird markets in Asia, and those would be another group of occupational exposures that would put people at great risk, depending on what pathogens are in the live animal markets. So it's very real. There are occupational exposures, and I would say that we're doing a pretty good job at developing educational materials for those workers. That is, our government and state agencies are reaching out to them in new ways.
You mentioned transmission to wild animals, and another discussion point that comes up is how much the virus is being transferred to wild animals or even house cats, and how could that lead to spread? If we had to prioritize, I know we should probably be doing everything, but is the risk bigger in terms of what's happening at farms, or do you see the risk as more the way in which it could get transmitted to wild animals and then spread across different groups, or do those two things play off each other?
Well, there is likely some wild animal exposure from the virus that's being amplified or replicated in the livestock. We know that because not only have cats been infected, but wild animals such as the birds that also feed on the farms, frequently the birds will get into the feed troughs for the dairy cattle and the beef cattle. They've succumbed to H5N1 infections. There's also some thought that perhaps rodents might be infected from, for instance, ingesting milk or spilled milk or some of the feed that's got oral secretions from infected dairy cows. So there is some interaction with wildlife that we don't have a good handle on, and that could be an explanation of how sometimes the viruses are moving from farm to farm. I've heard certainly that groups are maybe detecting H5N1 in rodents, and we know it's affecting what we call our year-round birds that are flying in and out of the barns. There's some talk that maybe insects would be mechanical transmitters. So just like a fly can transmit some of the bacteria, we have a picnic and there's a fecal material that's loaded with the enterotoxigenic E. coli, and that fly lands on your food, well, that can contaminate the food. And so we need to be aware of that dimension as well. For instance, the livestock to the wildlife transmission, and that's one of the components that argue that you need to include wildlife biologists in trying to mitigate these problems. And they too would be of value in a One Health way, along with human health professionals, animal health professionals, environmental health professionals.
I've heard some people describe the concentration of animals in certain operations with a negative connotation as a very strong incubator of viruses, where there's a lot of opportunity and cramped conditions for mutations to happen and for infection to spread really easily. Does that ring true to you?
Yeah, we see evidence of that, certainly for influenza A viruses that don't kill livestock, or where we have dense populations of animals, such as in the United States and pigs, or in live animal markets, farms that support live animal markets. We know that constant churning, replication of virus that's enzootic or endemic in these animals can generate novel progeny viruses through the mixing of viruses, as we chatted about before, or mutations. And those novel viruses may pop out of that flock, herd, live animal market, and spill over to new species and humans. And so there have been some really good studies, for instance, of the variety of influenza A strains in pigs. Canadian researchers have shown that the larger the pig operation and the more dense the animals are, the greater the variety of viruses. And so we've observed what you said to be true. And we've also observed in poultry, not in this country, but in other countries where avian flu is tolerated, that sometimes having a low pathogenic virus in those populations will be a catalyst for the generation of a highly pathogenic related virus. And so that's why there's really no tolerance of avian flu in the United States. Now, that could change because it's been economically very disastrous to have so many birds culled in this country. Some of the statistics are just amazing. I've heard, 50.5 million birds, billions of dollars, and we're seeing it through the price of eggs fluctuating, and the industry is suffering from it. So there's talk of maybe changing the way we do business and controlling avian flu in poultry. I don't know what will happen. Definitely, I think administering avian flu vaccines to livestock is, at least I believe, it's on the horizon. Other countries have done it, and it's performed pretty well. We've just been reticent to embrace it here in the United States.
The numbers are mind-blowing. They've long since passed the quantity where I can get my head around how big of a impact it's had. So this has all been really fantastic. Thank you so much for this information. The last subject I wanted to ask you about is just, how do you see the public perception of this topic and media coverage? Do you feel like the public is underinformed, or would it be better if information was communicated in a certain way? How are you seeing the current state of awareness?
Well, I think the news media people that cover this generally are science-oriented, and the ones that I've interacted with are very conscientious to inform the public in a way that doesn't cause panic, but in a way that also influences policy. And I mean, some of them double and triple check their facts. They're very responsible in getting the news out there and raising the discourse, the discussions about the pros and cons of new technologies and fighting this threat. So my hat's off to the science reporters out there that really do their homework and attempt to communicate truth in a balanced way. And I'd say the vast majority are like that. Now, there are some individuals who may be either less knowledgeable or more willing to seek the accolades of high social media activity from their reports and less balanced. And I think those of us in science, having experienced one or more sort of negative things where you've met with those people and seen something you said take out of context, we don't frequent them again. And so the good science reporters are often given the best interviews. And from that, what I think is remarkable, they're able to take what is pretty complicated technical stuff and make it palatable and understandable to the general population, which I think is a huge gift. And I greatly admire the science writers who do that effectively, and they're very valuable. And so, you know, that can be things like this right here, which will be a podcast or newsletter, news stories in the newspapers or on social media. There are many forms to get the information out there. And I just think the science writers are the best ones to listen to.
Very well said. Okay, so last question for you. Are there any projects that you're working on now that you are especially excited about or that you want people to know about?
Yeah, so seeing this, some of the money that the USDA is putting out there, we're competing multiple different proposals to see which ones the experts will like. We're trying to find ways to protect livestock. I mentioned the rabies recombinant vaccine with H5 in it that could be ramped up so quickly. We're also looking at using that vaccine in chicks. You know, would it protect the chicks? How could we administer it in aerosol without having to inject it every chick? It's so much work. And so we're trying to evaluate those things. We're proposing research. We're also working with the NIAID, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and testing a universal influenza vaccine that has four different viruses in it, inactivated, to try to give people protection against almost all the dangerous strains of avian flu. And there are many people like us that are attempting to develop new diagnostics. We're working with three diagnostic companies to try to get better tools out there for human and animal health care. So it's an interesting time, and hopefully a productive time, that will keep the human populations and animal populations in the future more healthy, despite this very complicated new threat of H5N1 strains that are spreading very rapidly here, especially in the United States.
Professor Gray, thank you so much for being one of our first guests on this podcast. Wonderful information that you've shared, and I appreciate the work that you're doing to help protect the population and to use science as a guide. So really appreciate your time, and thank you for joining us.
Adam, thank you for interviewing me, and I wish you every success with your new podcast, and hope it can help not only the people of Iowa, but the people across the nation.
Thank you. That's it for this week's episode of Canary in a Cornfield. Just a reminder, you can find us on social media, which includes X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and find our webpage at parkininstitute@drake.edu. And this podcast is also hosted by Substack Canary in a Cornfield, which will include some additional links and resources that go beyond just what's in the episode. So thank you all for tuning in, and I will be talking with you soon.